Hello, and welcome to This Week in Wealth. And no, your ears are not deceiving you. This is not Alex Steger. This is Ian Wenick, and I am joined by a very special guest back on for the first time since God only knows, Andrew Forch. How are you?
Hey, yes, I'm very good. It's good to be back. Yeah, a bit of a long leave there, but we're getting back into things. So, yeah, good to be here with you.
So I think you got to tell the audience before we hop into it. What, you were not hiding out in some sort of doomsday bunker. What have you been up to, and why have you been gone?
Yeah. The leave that I was on was paternity leave. So I had a baby. I had a daughter, my wife and I, on July 15. And so I've been away helping her and helping welcome our daughter into the world and into our home. And so that was just fantastic. And also, honestly, probably the first real reprieve, kind of extended reprieve from the news cycle that I've had in my career, which was nice. But now on the other side of it, yeah, definitely feeling a little bit like I've fallen behind. A lot can happen in a month, especially in this business. So we're playing catch up a little bit, but yeah, we're getting back into it.
So without any further ado, I believe that I'm up to the plate first. How about you throw me a couple of softballs and let's see where things go.
Yeah, well, you know, I came back on Monday, and I think by at least a day or two in, we already had a couple pretty mammoth stories come out. And I think one of those, probably the defining story of this week so far, was yours, Ian. If you could maybe just tell us what that is, we'll go kind of get into it from there. I've got a few kind of follow-up things that I'd like to ask you.
See, no, defining story, that puts just way too much pressure on me.
I know you're up to the task.
All right. So anyway, for our listeners, the big story of the week, the big deal scoop that we broke earlier was that Crescent, one of the largest REAs in the country, about $72 billion in assets, they've agreed to merge with Monticello Associates, which, no relation to Thomas Jefferson, that is a Denver-based investment consultancy with around $124 billion in assets. And so, you know, that's a big headline number, but there's a little bit of nuance to how these kinds of transactions with these consultancies work.
Well, tell us about that. And this is important because I think we've started to see this is a type of transaction that we've started to see more of, I think, over the last, I'll call it like a year and a half. But really, it's even kind of more recent than that. Yeah, just tell us exactly kind of why these deals make sense and why they're a little bit maybe different from the usual cadence of kind of RIA to RIA M&A that we've been seeing for years.
Yeah, so I think what makes these kinds of deals with investment consultancies interesting. So first, let's just back up and explain what an investment consultancy is. So it, though it's registered with the SEC as an RIA, it's not an RIA in the sense that it holds discretionary authority over clients' assets. It's not building financial plans and putting clients into model portfolios that they've constructed. So they're not charging that traditional 1% fee, maybe stepping down as assets go up. What these kinds of businesses do is they work with large institutions. Think university endowments, charitable organizations, other nonprofits. So a company like this, you know, they have massive headline numbers and assets, but the underlying profit margin is significantly smaller, because you're dealing with assets that are managed on a consultative basis as opposed to a discretionary basis.
Good. That's helpful, both for, I can imagine, the listener, and also a little bit for myself. So thank you for that. I'm curious because, we saw at the beginning of this year, Mariner Wealth Advisors, Marty Bicknell, they acquired NEPC. They acquired Cardinal Investment Advisors. It was Hightower bought NEPC. So clearly the mega RIAs, the kind of most acquisitive firms in this business, they're seeing serious value here, and they're deploying capital to bring that in-house. Why? Is this just a cross-selling opportunity? Why does this make sense for these businesses?
So I think, when I zoom out, I think what makes a deal like this make sense strategically is look at a company like CapTrust. And the way that a company like CapTrust operates is they call it a hub and spoke model, in which they'll have a core business in a major market. They try to target all the NFL cities, as they told me before, and they acquire ancillary practices around it. And so the idea is that when you're dealing with a lot of these large corporate clients or these institutional clients, those employees eventually become prospects. And so you can convert them. So it becomes both a lead generation opportunity and a rollover opportunity. So you can convert those client assets potentially from lower margin consultative business into discretionary AUM relationship. It's kind of similar to how a lot of RIAs, you know, those kind of big for Edelman, was how the IRA 401k rollover was kind of their bread and butter. You can convert these clients, and you can argue, you know, if you're trying to make deals, you can buy these investment consultancies at a lower headline multiple than you're going to have to pay for a traditional RIA. So yeah, if I can pay 9x, 10x, 11x for a consultancy with tens of billion assets, and I can maybe convert over a fraction of that or generate a $100 million worth of client assets, well, that's probably a little bit easier than paying 15, 16, 17 for some of these premium RIA, discretionary RIA assets out in the marketplace that are running bank processes.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, does it work the same in the other direction where is there value to be gained for the RIA's existing kind of advisory clients by bringing an institutional investment consultancy in-house? Or are those, is it kind of a one-directional benefit there?
You know, that's a good question. I think that probably in theory, you can go bi-directionally. Like, I kind of think about how, this is a good example, is creative planning. A couple years ago, they bought a company called America's Best 401k, which was a 401k plan record keeper and administrator. And so they brought those capabilities in-house. So yeah, it does help, I think, in the other direction that you can provide an additional range of services to your corporate clients. You know, you mentioned Mariner. Mariner has done a couple of transactions where they've brought on those investment consultancies. They've also brought on additional value-add businesses. Like, they bought an investment bank so that their clients could sell their businesses through Mariner. And so when you think about it from that way, it's a way to get better wallet share with your underlying clients.
Well, the last thing I'll ask on this point, and maybe this is kind of getting ahead of myself, and is a new kind of deal that we're seeing, and I don't know if you've thought, you know, too long and hard about this, but is there reason for skepticism at all here? Just in terms, I mean, we talk all the time about, you know, kind of traditional RIA M&A. Like, is this a good thing for the clients? Are these deals a good thing for the investment consultancies' clients? I mean, these RIAs often have one or several kind of private equity overlords to answer to. Is there reason for skepticism or trepidation here at all?
You know, that's a good question. And the way that I kind of think about it is, I think that ultimately the client, what matters to them is the relationship with their advisor. Like, we talk, these businesses are mega institutions, but what ultimately supports them are these tight, deeply held personal relationships based on trust. And so if I'm a client, they say, hey, I can access all of this through my advisor that I trust, my golfing buddy. Yeah, why not go for it? You know, think about, you know, we'll verge a little bit more towards like the fintech sphere. Think about why RIAs love using a company like Pontera so much, where they can manage a client's underlying held away 401k assets. You know, I feel like a lot of people, they err on the side of, you can call it simplicity if you're being charitable, or laziness if you're feeling less charitable. You want to do everything in one portal. You want to do everything through one kind of point of contact. Because that's why, you know, the ability to manage those kind of held away assets through one advisor you already work with, that's why that's so popular. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not an RIA client myself. Who knows? Maybe one day. But yeah, it's, I think that you err towards simplicity in working with the trusted person as opposed to having multiple points of entry.
Yeah, fair enough. Good stuff. We appreciate the breakdown. What else did we have on the docket today?
Yeah, so, you know, like I said to our listeners, I did not give Andrew a break whatsoever. God knows what your sleep schedule is like. But look, you know, I threw you right into the fire. What did you write about our friends down in Atlanta, Homrich Berg, this week?
Yeah, that's a big deal. So Homrich Berg, one of the larger RAs in the southern U.S., I think they're up over $25 billion in assets now. That firm has rebranded. They're going to be called HB Wealth now going forward. And it, this is sort of, you know, look, a rebrand is a rebrand. You change some signage, you update your website, but what it signals about the company is much bigger. And it kind of hints at a change that we've been tracking over the last couple of years among kind of the biggest, fastest growing firms, particularly those backed by private equity now, which is the kind of maturation beyond the status as a founder-led business and kind of a personality practice. Obviously, you know, look, Hammersberg is far past, I think, the status of a personality practice. But, you know, Hammersberg does refer to the two founders there. And so HB Wealth is kind of being represented as, you know, honoring the founders and the company's legacy and the company's roots, while maybe also setting it up for a future as a true kind of national institution. And we've talked about that, right? We've seen countless large RIAs, founders, entrepreneurs who built and grew very large, very successful RIAs. Have kind of stepped back or been urged in some cases to step back by shareholders, and it's all part of kind of the maturation of the industry that we've been following.
Yeah, I mean, I think back some of these even predate us. Like I think about how the RIA formerly known as Hanson McLean became Allworth. And you know, I feel like this is something that's part of like the traditional private equity playbook. And it also makes sense. You know, it's kind of about reducing that kind of key man or key woman risk where you no longer have that core personality, that core rainmaker driving the business. It's about something that's bigger than them, something that's kind of self-sustaining. So I'm like, give me that, you know, what's the context for where HB Wealth, and it's going to take some time for that to set in, you know, where is HB Wealth right now? What have they been up to? What's kind of prompted this the last couple of years? What kind of changes have they had in the C-suite and in their ownership structure?
Yeah, well, they have now two private equity backers. They had been backed since, I believe, 2021 by New Mountain Capital. But there was a big deal in the fall of last year. They took an investment from TPG. It was the growth equity arm, TPG Growth. And that's a huge deal. I mean, they're something like the, I'm going to butcher this, but they might be like the fifth or the sixth biggest private equity firm in the country. Do they back Creative Planner or did they try to back Creative Planning?
TPG has a stake in Creative Planning.
Yeah. A stake in Creative. I mean, that's a real huge vote of confidence for Hammersberg. And then, you know, they've been an acquirer, maybe not as breathless as some others, but they've been an opportunistic acquirer. And so they followed up that TPG investment by acquiring $6.4 billion WMS Partners. That was a, I believe, a kind of multifamily office and ultra high net worth focused RIA based in Maryland. And so, look, they're pushing up market. They want to become more competitive among the ultra wealthy and perhaps institutional clientele as well. You know, they've been trying to do this for some time, and look, they're well on their way, I think. And so HB Wealth sort of positions them for that push, and to really sort of fulfill what they see as their future identity. You know, they want to be one of the big guns there in the South and beyond. So yeah, they're on their way.
So you slipped a couple of Hammersbergs in there. It's going to take time to adjust. Like dropping the group out of Wealth Enhancement Group, I can't. It takes a long time to just call them.
I mean, you know, you still have to edit that out of every story that I file about them. So, yeah, look, I think we get locked. It's the same thing with like Facebook Meta, and there's a little bit of resistance. I don't want to call them Meta, even though that's what they are. You know.
I still remember before CityWire days when I would write about Google, I had an editor who'd always insist that he just call him Alphabet. When
yeah,
like,
right.
Have you ever heard someone call him Alphabet?
Yeah, yeah. It's never happened.
So we talk a little bit about kind of these founders, these leaders stepping back. In the case of HB Wealth, I mean, we had one of their founders, it was David Hammersberg. He stepped away relatively early on in the firm's growth cycle to go work for the Falcons owner, Arthur Blank. And then Andy Berg, who kept operational, he stepped aside relatively recently in way of Thomas Carroll, who I think
he's still the chair. So he's still involved, but yeah, it's a step back for sure.
Yeah, it's a step back from like a pure day-to-day operational role. And it's kind of curious, though. I think about a lot of these big personalities. You know, Rick Edelman, a good example. Elliot Weissbluth, who we've spoken about and written, who we spoke about on this last episode, last week before you came back. You know, these big personalities, they do find ways to stick around in this business, even if it's not directly running the company that they founded. And so in that sense, I believe that two recognizable names, including one I just mentioned, have resurfaced relatively recently.
There's a great great segue there. Yeah, so Rick Edelman joined the board of a tax software firm called Tax Status, and that's a big get for them. Now, he's not the only one. They've also added Eric Clark, the founder and former CEO of technology giant Orion, to its board. So those are big big endorsements, big votes of confidence, and big names in the industry. Folks know them. And yeah, I think there's two different tracks. I mean, to what you're describing, I think some folks are entrepreneurs through and through, and that's kind of all they want to be doing. I think of, not to say that these guys aren't entrepreneurs through and through, but I don't know. I think of somebody like a Peter Raimondi, who at every step has restarted, I think, three or four kind of quite large, serious RIA businesses. Now, I just spoke with John Cranbier, who is, you know, on his second or third kind of RIA build. So some folks go right back to building. Depends on kind of their, you know, personality, their want, their career, just kind of position, where they're at in their career, their age. And so we do see, I mean, when folks take a step back, they stay involved. Rick's on a couple boards. I think Eric Clark is on a couple boards. So that's a good way for folks to kind of keep their hands in different pots and stay involved and keep abreast of sort of the latest developments and solutions in the industry, and kind of offer a guiding hand there. And it's also a good endorsement for the firms. I mean, those are big names for a firm like Tax Status to kind of have associated. So in some respects, it's kind of legitimacy by association, if I can say that. So I don't know. It's good.
You know, Rick is a good example in particular, because he's had this really fascinating post Edelman Financial Engines life, where now he's become this kind of cryptocurrency evangelist. And so you see some of these people, these founders, when they're not really bound by the core organization, their careers and go in really different directions. I mean, even Elliot Weissbluth, who we talked about, I mean, he was on the board of a Canadian oil and gas company.
Rick and his wife Jean funded the creation of a dinosaur museum. I mean, it's super cool.
This is true. I got to go visit there soon.
That's our next CityWire field trip. I think our team building outing, we've got to go to the Dino Museum.
Hey, you know, pack your pith helmets and your pickaxes. I'll be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got just a minute or two before we've got to bounce. So I will throw this to you. What has been the most and least surprising thing about parenting so far?
That's a good question. Most surprising is, that's a good question. I kind of got to think on it.
This is how I stay employed.
Yeah, that's good. Now I feel how it is to be on the other side of the table. I think most surprising is honestly how, I'm going to anger a lot of other parents out there by saying this, but and part of this is I'm, you know, it's early days here. She's like 5.5 weeks old. But I think I'm surprised by how relatively easy it has been. I mean, it's a lot. The sleep disruptions are a lot. There's more of a physical burden on my wife, obviously, but it's been easy to care. I mean, caring for an infant is easy to do. The tasks are not hard. Changing diapers, feeding her, you know, holding her, engaging with her. It's easy to do. It's demanding in the frequency that you have to rotate through this cycle. At least surprising is how much I want to hang out with her. I mean, it's a lot, and you can be kind of overwhelmed, and then she looks at you and you just totally melt, and it's like, oh yeah, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is what my place is. And so I think, yeah, that's another surprise is like, I don't know, I'm young, I'm 28, and there's always a sense of kind of like, you know, you're figuring out your place, and it's like, I don't have to figure it out. Like, my place is right here with her, caring for her. And so that's been, I just didn't really consider that before her birth. It's been a lot of fun. She's great to hang out with. She's got a little personality. She is who she is already. It's cool, man. It's a lot of fun.
I cannot wait to see what Alex texts you after he listens to this episode.
Hopefully sweet things. I don't know. I'm
Oh,
being a little too, I'm too earnest on Maine here, but listen, our readers deserve a little insight into who the reporters are, right? I'll share this bit of myself. That's okay.
well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we've got. But Andrew, it's great to have your voice back on this podcast.
Yeah, good to be
And
here.
I look forward to having you on many more episodes of This Week in Wealth to come.
Me too. Thanks, guys.